Well, welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. Can you believe we got a warm November day? Here we're coming up. I mean, this weather temperature is unusual, 70 degrees, and here we are in November. It's a sunny day. Well, that's what it is in Illinois. I don't know. Denise, what's it like out in Denver?
Oh, boy, we have our first storm coming through. So it dropped the temps from 70 down to 50, and it's supposed to be wet and a little bit of mushy snow coming at us later this evening, I think. They've gotten snow up in the hill country. And, Doug, I want to have everybody say happy birthday to my daughter. She turned 29 today.
Things it's your daughter's
going
birthday
well
today?
For her up.
Happy birthday.
Uh-huh.
Happy birthday.
And her judge is going to give a call down to the prosecutor's office and say she's a good person, get her a full-time job there besides the clerkship. So they are just taking beautiful care of her. You know, she's gotten coffee given to her, cake, flowers. I mean, they are really a nice group of people up there in Maryland. And I will say this, Maryland has their first Veterans Treatment Court that started. I was bugging her to get their judges over in the county she's in interested, so I don't know if she's done that, but I was pushing because that state did not have a Veterans Treatment Court. And the other thing I want to say, Doug, before we get started with the topic that we're going to talk about today, is, you know, I put out about the research studies that are going on for Gulf War vets. And I get comments back of not wanting to be a guinea pig. And, you know, comments like frustration and they know what's happened to us and all. Let me tell you, okay, first of all, I was a nurse for decades, both active duty and then reserve and then to the Gulf War. I've carried on afterwards because of that nurse oath and to maintain my ties with my fellow vets and not just get answers for myself, but to help them get answers and to help them get what they need on their treatment, whatever we can do. But I get so many negative comments and people, you know, putting down research. And I want to say this to the world, okay? My thesis involved open-heart surgery patient education, okay? That was back in the 70s that I got my master's degree in nursing. And I will say, guys, I trained down at the Houston Medical Center, also in the Dallas Medical Center. But Houston was why I went to the school I went to, because I wanted to be at the Texas Medical Center. That was where I was living, where my folks and friends and family was. I was a Texas girl. I used both centers, Dallas and Houston, in my bachelor's and master's. But I will tell you, people, when you're working on things that are not fully understood by medicine, we are lucky to have had a handful of doctor researchers get involved with us. Some of these researchers had input with the ones that had AIDS, HIV. Some of them have dealt with the chronic fatigue civilian patients that are finally getting NIH attention as the news for them. Is they've gotten NIH involved now. They keep pushing. And most of it's come from the people that are sick, that might be in bed working off their computers, hooking into a live webinar, doing everything they can for themselves. Our vets are a little bit slower. They don't get it. To make a difference in medicine, to get us the answers, because honest to God, we didn't have tests set up to show the damage that was done by the exposures in our body. We didn't have a checklist. Like, you know, if you come in with respiratory problems, it may be a pulmonary emboli. It may be pneumonia. We know to run chest x-rays, do this and that. They're standard things that you go through to be sure you're either dealing with a pulmonary emboli or you've got a case of pneumonia, you know, and then you go into the treatment. Okay? We didn't have that, Doug. We did not have the medical knowledge, okay, out there of what to do with low-level exposure to pesticides, to chemical agents, to PV pills being used in the wrong way, depleted uranium. We didn't have that. So for 25 years now, we have fought to get there. We were blocked by the VA that wanted to push it off on stress. Why? It'd be cheaper if they could say we all have PTSD. Okay? Much cheaper than diagnostic studies and what we need. So we've had to push them to look at the physical problem. Agent Orange, that's, you know, it came out of one place. I think it was up in Chicago. Somebody said, well, let's pull some fat tissue and see if they have dioxin. That was the only thing they did at that time. I mean, that was what? They're getting closer to a 50-year time period on Vietnam. They didn't have all the medical science we have today. And what we've had to do is really go out and find the medical research tools that may be in a university for research and utilize those. We're pushing for the biomarkers, the genetics, which is all just beginning a whole explosion in medicine of using genetics and biomarkers. And all those things are going to end up being standard diagnostic procedures. We're not quite there. We are not there as far as treatment except to offer comfort, which would be acupuncture, yoga. We are just now opening the doors to more and more research with different medicines. There's some funded this past go-around for 2014 that will be getting started here shortly on treatment trials. But I want people to understand this is medicine. I was there. I wrote, you know, my thesis on, you know, how they develop cardiac catheterization, which is so common in every major town. You can get a cardiac cath, you can get a stress test. That was started by a medical doctor or resident that said, hey, I think we could put a tube up there into the heart and look at the blood flow in the vessels. Okay? I remember all this history, and I'm trying to get people to key in that if you have an undiagnosed illness or an unknown, it's not standard out there in the medical world. You know, that's why the VA doesn't know what to do. The standard doctors don't, except for a handful that have gotten into environmental health or integrative health. So the only way we can help ourselves is to realize the truth that we are pushing medical research. We are pushing the realms of medicine. We are the breaking point in medicine right now.
I mean, that has been known from, we've known that from day one. I mean, Andres and Tom and all those guys and Asa Durakovich, you know, I mean, Bill and all these guys that we worked with all the way, they said that from day one. I mean, when we started bringing this up, I remember the CDC and IOM, NIH, they were so angry because the applications we are having and what we were putting into, because all these guys were extraordinarily healthy and came back extraordinarily sick, is pushing the envelope in environmental medicine for the entire everybody, because as they got this better living through chemistry and all these complex exposures and all these complex material problems and outgassing, nobody knows about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. And to this day, The VA doctor doesn't even want to hear it.
Well, look at it this way. I went in and dug around to see what they did for mustard gas in World War One. They knew it destroyed their lungs. They knew they had hospital wards with people suffering from this, but they didn't know, you know, what do you use to diagnose that? What do you use to treat it? You know, atomic vets, they didn't know. The downwinders didn't know what to do. What tests do we do? How do we prove that this is there in their bodies? There wasn't that much medical research going on back then, okay? And so it's become refined. We have more tools, more people thinking. But we've also had cuts in medical research money, you know? As our budget problems, we've kind of pushed down medical research, and they're struggling out there. And people say, well, they're making money off of us. No, research costs money. And that's just the way it goes until we get answers. And as I said, on my first trip to D.C., which was the Conference on Health Consequences of the Gulf War, when I saw the DOD playing games of where they put the collection devices upstream from exposures, and all the things that we talked about, Doug, was that they can give a dog and pony show, but the proof is in our body, and this is how we get to it, people. So, Gulf War vets out there, and the deploy particularly, you are being paid attention to. But you have to get to these research studies. You will learn much more about your body. You will have doctors that are interested in trying to make the breaks that are needed. Dr. Klimas was involved with HIV. That got handled, with the retroviral treatment. They've got a diagnosis. They've got a treatment. She's worked on civilian chronic fatigue, then she, got involved with the Gulf War vets. Dr. Baronic was in Georgetown, was involved with the chronic fatigue group. I saw one of his research studies, and I reached out to him. Our hypercoagulation came about from a discussion that I triggered at the CDC. We had an independent research, and then it ended up our reviewer for that journal, peer-reviewed journal article, that we had an expert at the VA that got involved up in Minneapolis. So, people, if you want answers, and this doesn't go just for Gulf War vets, if you have a condition and you're getting treated, you really should go online, Google, find out what research is going on. Find out all about it, have your questions answered, and these are saving lives out there. There's some trials that end up badly, true. But when you don't have any answers and your condition's not getting better, this is how you learn. I was at the Texas Medical Center. I was there. I got to observe open-heart surgeries by Dr. Cooley and Dr. DeBakey. I saw the heart transplants. I saw medical research happening to the benefit of people before we had pacemakers, So I'm giving a holler out, particularly to our Gulf War vets. We're having trouble getting them to look at the non-deploy because they didn't get it as mixed of exposure. But we will get there, guys. But it needs all of us pushing in the same direction.
The part that's so flustering for everybody is the fact that the administration and the guys that are responsible abandon it, and I understand it, because when we were told to hide all of the evidence and lie in our reports, as you've seen both of you, we talked about it. I mean, the entire cost, the entire toxic nature of war today, and the entire toxic nature when we destroy an infrastructure, releases all of this stuff that nobody has any idea what the interaction is. I mean, it's a horrific effect. I mean, when Bill Baumschweiger was talking about this and showing the neurological effects early on, and I saw those guys at IOM and the Presidential Council, the PSOP, they were just kind of like freaking out.
Yeah, I remember taking one of our flight surgeons up to the room when we were examining our Gulf War vets, and their eyes were bugging out. It finally made sense to them.
The 82nd Airborne Division surgeon, remember when I got so sick at CDC, and you and Tom and him saved my life. I mean, it finally came together for him, and I remember he was sitting there on full active duty at full colonel, chief surgeon for the entire 82nd Airborne Division, and he was freaking out because all of a sudden it came together with him, what we were discussing at CDC and looking at this stuff and then seeing people getting sick in front of him.
The look on his face was terrifying
because he realized he couldn't do anything to stop the nightmare.
Yeah, you were actually taken by him in his private car, I guess, to go get some medicine to help you. And I always wondered, I wish I had been a little fly on the rooftop to hear y'all's conversation.
It was pretty interesting.
They have to get out there and push. They have to share the knowledge with others. We still have a problem with people taking in the material and the risk, and the doctors at the VA not being informed. Well, guys, it's our duty now. It will help yourself. It will help others. I've got the printed pamphlets that people can download. Get them out, wallpaper the VA facility with it. Give it to the doctors, It's a different age and time. We're no longer stupid patients. We are informed. We are educated. We have a sworn duty to our fellow veterans to get involved, to get into the research proposals, to get into the studies, to get into the risk. As I've told you, things are not good at the local VAs. You know, we've got to push an overall education effort for the doctors.
One thing we did get good news on, Allison Hickey was fired or forced out. She was head of the Veterans Benefit Administration. And, you know, remember years ago we asked her to help us and she wouldn't.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of bureaucratic mess that goes on, okay, and they do need a clean out. But Allison was one that we have really worked with over the past year on the claims problem. She was responding. And now we kind of have to wait till this new guy gets his feet on the ground a little better and if he's going to be promoted to and confirmed as an undersecretary or if they're going to bring in somebody new. But Allison was trying to reach out and help the Gulf War vets. It's a shame that what brought her down was, you know, what I call nepotism within a system. And that's what happened was nepotism. No way around it. People were forced to move, and that's what, she was overall in charge of the benefits, and, you know, she was a top dog for that, and she may have made some personal errors in trying to move people around and help them professionally, but, you know, there's nepotism within any agency.
I think
we had investigations in other agencies, we would find it in the education department and various departments.
The thing that bothered me most with Allison, since she was informed and knew about what was happening with the toxic exposures, and she knew the documents were out there, but even when the guys would submit their claims, they would hide the documents and not tell the soldier about them. Or when they went to the service officer, the service officer didn't have the information and wasn't told. And everybody, all the service members were expected to develop this fully developed claim on their own without having any of the information was deliberately hidden from them.
Well, and one of the problems was, Doug, you know, I've been working on this 25 years. I have had email chains, you know, with Yahoo email. We've had websites set up. We were pushing the news out there. We had good journalists you know, with USA Today, we had him, Dave Parks down in Birmingham, I believe. No, he was in Dallas. We had different ones. It wasn't throughout the nation, but people, vets, were not keeping their ears and eyes open either because we're now getting them in 25 years later, have no knowledge about Senator Riegel's report, haven't read that, haven't looked at the YouTubes that have the, you know, that we've gotten things up on YouTube. They have not been connected, and it's a personal effort, too. And a lot of them denied they were having problems. They have, you know, kept their nose to the ground, working, getting out of the military, setting up their civilian life, raising a family. You know, unless you put it under their face, they didn't go out and look.
Well, see, that's
and
one of the problems.
It's terribly frustrating for some of us that have been doing this for 25 years, tried to get the info out there as widely as we could, you know, all across to our fellow veterans, but also the service officers, to doctors. And, yes, we were facing resistance because the DOD was the problem here. Our leaders were the problem. They didn't speak up. We didn't have any generals speaking up and saying, whoa, we got to take care of these people, and they're not all PTSD guys.
Well, I mean, that's what goes into, and see, that's, I think, the problem with the vet. The vet is so bought into the system that they believe these guys will take care of them, and this is a total abandonment. I mean, when Joyce and everybody put Beyond Treason together, it's truly that where it's at, because through all the generations, all of us went to war, all everybody else. Ray, your guys went to war. I mean, you lost your whole unit. You got abandoned, and then they come back and they think that these people really do care and they really take care of them. But as we look at it, day after day, we got environmental contamination and military installations across the nation. Last week, as you know, we came up with all this contamination right there out there in Colorado again, and they don't want to clean it up. We got it right here at Chanute Air Force Base. We got it in Indiana. We've got it all over creation. And then we've got it in all these nations that we've totally trashed. So I can understand why they don't want the acknowledgement, because the cost is astronomical. It's just not for the U.S. handful of U.S. military, but it's for everybody else that we trashed when we did this stuff.
Just this week I saw something come out where they did the nuclear testing, and they didn't cover the people that did the cleanup, you know?
Doug, one of the indicators that I see, because I look at things sometimes, you know, you can't see the woods for all the trees, and I'm standing back looking at trees sometimes, but one of the indicators I see with Vietnam and Gulf Wars is a divorce rate. Something is causing a divorce rate. Something is behind the scenes. It's in the family. It's causing a lot of aggravation, irritation. And when a guy comes back from overseas, he's a different person or a lady. And so what is causing, there's something there. And they have to be able to look at that and then diagnose it and find out what is going on. Because if it's a common thing that's going on with these people, there is something real taking place in their lives. And it's causing a lot of damage to a lot of people. So that's one indicator we don't look at sometimes and tie it with exposures and life-changing situations. But it has a neutral, you know, damaging effect on the people who were involved in it. So what is it?
Now,
what is the commonality?
I have to also mention that, Paul Lyons, we had his wife on 6 months after his death, and I've just found out this past week and went into depression that one of the people I was communicating with had been a JAG lawyer, okay, from Louisiana, and I just noticed it's been football season, and I was noticing I wasn't getting all the Saints stuff. She was a real Saints backer, and I said, whoa, I haven't talked to her in a while, and I know she had breast cancer, had replacement surgery for her breast, and knew she was having some problems, so I went to her Facebook page, and shock. She was having reactions. She had fought the VA to, you know, provide care, follow up, and she got infected. And it happened rather quickly over a weekend, and I grabbed my calendar and said, how did I miss this? I usually am all the time on Facebook keeping up with people and phone calls. And I went and found her page and went through it and found out that weekend that I was up for my daughter's graduation from law school that she had died. Sepsis had set in. She had a fever. She didn't get to the ER. She should have put that first. You know, and people were telling her to go to the ER. She started with a low grade, and it built up to a full-blown infection. People hadn't heard from her. She had friends that finally got the police out. They knocked down the door and found her and got her to the hospital, but the sepsis had set in so much that it was unrecoverable. So I kind of got very depressed, you know, thinking, how did I miss this? I put the date together with, you know, I had Paul going down that affected me terribly. I had a mock trial that we finally got to see our daughter, you know, in a mock trial down in Houston trying to get up to Paul's funeral, which didn't work out because my daughter succeeded in her team, you know, going toward the finals. And then we had the graduation coming up, and I was still dealing with Paul's family. And I completely missed it that this had happened. And so we lost a very educated, informed lawyer, JAG officer. And, yes, I think that I've had enough females out to have breast cancer develop. So it's another area that we need to push. And the CDMRP does have a lot of programs for research, and it actually started with breast cancer, I believe, in the history. It was a congressman that, you know, got funding for breast cancer, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, was one of their first programs. And, yeah, I've had enough Gulf War vet females with breast cancer. So, you know, it's ignited me to, you know, speak up for the breast cancers and females on our Gulf War vets, and possibly, we don't know. We don't know our vet about our Vietnam female vets if they had that trouble. You know, there wasn't quite the network from Vietnam for people to communicate easily using computers and all. And they were in a different time. I mean, I'm saying, you know, roughly about getting close to 50 years for them. And, you know, medical science, you know, was still developing then. We didn't have as much research or counting. And we know that before we've talked about this, Dugway, we haven't mentioned it in a program yet, but we knew that there was a lot of people coming back from OIF, OEF, with cancers. We had one of the sisters of a chaplain that got a cancer that was doing journalism work and getting that out, you know, in her local papers. It didn't spread much further than that, but our cancers being our brain tumors that are killing people. Breast cancer can kill if it's not treated, and, you know, if you go through surgeries and, you know, the replacement techniques, you can develop infections, and our immune system is definitely involved. They're going to carry a higher risk. Cardiac problems. I mean, it wakes me up to so much more work we have to do. And, you know, if we can get all the vets realizing how important this is and getting them pull all together, I've pushed the Georgetown study. We can take 50 patients as soon as they get their funding rolling. That's the last step, is to get the money to them. They're getting close, so I started recruiting. We can take up to 50. We need at least 10 normals, normal, healthy veterans to participate as a control group. We have now, I think, gotten up to 30 on a waiting list, and I'm saying we're going to put 60 or 70 on that waiting list because people always cancel for different reasons. We have the biomarker study going with the first consortium. I just called them before you called me, Doug, and I was hoping to see big numbers because that's going to need 300 people. And right now, I think we've had, I just put a notice out about that, but I've been pushing that study out on our GUT4 Illnesses Facebook page, and I think we may have close to maybe 20 at Boston, but we need 100 from Boston, at least 100 from the Boston, 100 from Florida, and we can fill more than that, but Texas will come on next year doing that. But that's where we get the biomarkers identified so we can target the treatment.
Well, these biomarkers would be critical because, I mean, the brand-new Army Times just literally came in the mailbox a few minutes ago. And Patricia Kimmy, who's been absolutely wonderful in trying to help us, you know, as a writer at Army Times, the quote is, deployment health records are lapsing, DOD waiving its own rule on combat data. I mean, you know, years ago we put it in place, we were directly involved with Kilpatrick and his office up there in Rochester to get the records, get everything locked down, and they haven't been doing it.
No.
So they've been deliberately ignoring the health environmental assessments to put it in the medical record so that we could have the direct correlation between the known exposures once the people got sick and doing it. So, I mean, it was a deliberate act that Patricia Kimmy is reporting right now in the brand new Army Times on page 10.
Well, that's one thing. You know, I want to say that Allison once, once Robert McDonald came in as secretary, she listened to us more after that. I had met her when she got the job a number of times and was trying to get her a focus on that. We had a terrible backlog, not only Vietnam, but Gulf War vets, even some World War II vets getting taken care of, and Korean vets. So they had a terrible backlog on the claims. That was all, you know, there when she walked in and trying to clean that up and get it better. So then getting her to focus on the different groups. But she did start helping in the past 6 months, 8 months, but other things interfered.
But then you got the other thing.
What I'll say is the acting undersecretary, the acting one that's holding her place right now, came from the DOD. He was a colonel, and he was involved with the DOD with you know, deployment and, you know, with current OIF. He's been at the VA just 5 years, I think. So his knowledge and connections back to the DOD, we need to hit him. I don't know if he'll become the undersecretary, but we need to hit Danny Pommel now that this has been a problem, and that with his connections back to the DOD, maybe there's a little glimpse of an opportunity here.
Well, yeah, but the other thing, too, is we go back with Shinseki cutting the direct orders for medical care with DU and everybody that was ignored. So you got DOD people going into the VA that through the years, and we've all met them, we talked to them, we tried to convince them otherwise, that we're putting roadblocks up. I mean, this was deliberate all the way through, and now Patricia's committee is reporting it again.
Yeah.
I mean, it just...
Well,
the
other thing that's happened, Vietnam vets, two things. Vietnam vets on their extension for their presumptive. They were dateline, too. And I don't think the Congress passed that to extend their deadlines. So that's critical that that didn't happen. It kind of reflects that we've got a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and we're going to have problems, people. They did not pass that for the Vietnam vets. And right now, currently, we're having a push on those toxic wound bills in the Senate and House to get them through, which we've talked about in another program. So there's a lot of things going on that are going to affect us, and I, you know, with the budget and the debt, you know, it's going to be hard times, people, and we're going to get hit, and we already got hit with the Vietnam vets' presumptives not being extended. They had a fight on their hands, and I haven't checked for sure, but I know John Stewart was out in Washington pushing for the 9/11 first responders that was running out of money and that needed extension. I don't know. I have not checked to see if they got that through. But, you know, money is tight, and, you know, the Republicans are bound and determined to cut that $1 trillion down. So they're going to cut where they can. And, you know, those of us that are involved, we need to get the word out to people, and it's going to take a battle royal.
Well, that was the whole reason when the money got tied up and everything has happened, why we worked on the preventive medicine. I mean, I sat on the preventive medicine panel for the Center for Disease Control for Gulf War Illness, and even while we're putting that through, I was fighting like mad. I mean, Jim Toot and I were fighting like mad to get everything prevented so that we end up in this mess, and now we're just seeing a toxic mess over and over again, and more casualties and more problems, denied care, delayed care, inaccurate records, hidden records, destroyed records, I mean, tampering with emails, retaliation. I mean, it's a non-ending thing that I'm flustered.
Yeah, I'm sorry I've kind of switched our topic today, but it was right on the top of my mind, and I had to bring it up of what's happening up there. And happening across the board to our veterans. And, you know, they say they're going to pay attention to the veterans. Well, not, you know, extending deadlines for the Vietnam vets, and ours is coming up December 2016, which is next year, you know, and much less our presumptive, you know, theirs. And much less this bill for, you know, toxic centers so that we can look at the generational effect. That is critical. We need that. But, of course, they're not going to want that because the proof would come.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like when Haley's team got cut out. They knew what was coming at them, and, you know, they destroyed our collaborative center at UT Southwest and stopped his research just when we were about to cover much more than the CBs.
That's flustering. Well, I mean, let's move on. I mean, what we wanted to do, we want to talk tactics today, and all this is tied together because you got to have a plan when you're going into combat, you're going into war. You have to have yourself properly equipped and everything. You have to have the equipment to do it. You need to know what you're going to do when it comes out to it. And what's even more flustering, all the tactics that you learned in the military or should apply in the military is now having them become crucial and critical in your everyday life if you live in the city or if you live in the rural area. I mean, crime is out of control. There's no doubt about that. And the threat to everybody is very, very real. and law enforcement can't respond effectively. I mean, when you're in a rural area and you call the sheriff, you got a 30 or 40 minute response time. Well, you know, I had a really, really good friend of mine who's an FBI agent that told me, retired FBI agent, said, you know, a cop ain't nothing but a historian with a gun. You know, so he's taking down notes and trying to reconstruct something that already happened and has no way to do anything. So, I mean, it gets, to me, it all comes back together because we've had incident after incident where the civilian police are mimicking the military. And we've had incident after incident where the civilians are mimicking the military, whether they were in the military or not. They get into a situation, they want to mimic them. And all it turns out to be a friggin' nightmare. And this goes back to what we said. I mean, Ray, you and I have talked about, Denise, you've been up there treating the casualties on the front line of the worst of the worst. Ray, you were out there, God almighty, I didn't want to be described that nightmare. What is going on? I mean, we see today as technology has changed and everybody wants to buy all his gizmos and his equipment. And, you know, I wrote up a report, gadgets and gizmos don't save your life, they don't protect you, they don't get your job done, they just interfere. I mean, what the heck is going on?
Well, I think they want to look like the military, Doug. They want to have all the uniforms and all the weapons and all the stuff. But in the military, it's a whole different deal because you're out there to kill somebody. The law enforcement are there to arrest people and to take them down. If they're not willing to walk in there and really face an enemy and eliminate them, they're dressed up, but they're not ready for combat because the bad guy is ready. He don't care. He's going to take them down if he can. And in combat, you know, you talk about stacking them up. Well, they're in there to kill the bad guy. And so it's a whole different mentality. Nowadays, you know, the law enforcement is really under the microscope, so they're going to be careful about what they do. They're going to hesitate, really. And when you hesitate, you die. That's all there is to it. The bad guy is ready. He's got a plan. And so when you're walking in there with a half of a plan or you got a parachute or you got a plan B, the bad guy only has one plan. He wants to get out of there, and he don't care who he takes out in the meantime. So I think that's one of the major problems that we're facing, even law enforcement is, you know, when you're in combat, it's black and white. It comes down to life or death. But in the rest of the world, it's not like that. You know, yeah, they'll do what they have to do, but you're going to lose two or three guys in the process.
And I think so, you know, all of us have lost friends. I mean, I lost some friends, individuals in law enforcement. They went up against a drug dealer, known drug dealer, and they stacked up like their current military thing is. They'll do stacking, sure. And they were marching up the front guy, and the guy unloaded with a shotgun.
Right.
I mean,
right.
They had all their equipment on, sort of like they're, you know, in the middle of a city, and they're dressed like they're going into a jungle. To me, it doesn't make any sense at all.
No.
I mean, if you're going after the bad guy, you don't want the bad guy to know that you're coming after him. I mean, you want to get to the bad guy, sneak up and get him without him knowing that you're there or coming after him.
Yeah.
And all this stuff goes a heck in a handbasket, and then the preparation seems to be non-existent. I mean, and I know this is bothering for you and is critical for you and bringing back in on there. I mean, you lived through one of the worst nightmares of all, you know, with the Ridge, where you lost most of your unit. I mean, you walked into and hit an entire, regular NVA?
Yeah, these were NVA Army. So that's the ones that we dealt with all the time, was up on the DMZ. They were crossing over to go south, and we were a blocking force to try and stop them. So, you know, there were regiments of them, 2,000 or 3,000 of them at a time over in the DMZ. And several times our company had to go up against a battalion of NVA. If it weren't for the Air Force and the air cover and the Puff the Magic Dragon and artillery and everybody, you know, they weren't really scared of us. You know, they knew we were pretty dedicated to what we were doing. But our backup was what they were scared of because we were outnumbered most of the time. In their backyard too, so that makes a big difference.
Well, I think most people don't even the average soldier. I mean, unless you were in the frontline unit, doesn't even understand the structure. I mean, you got a squad of 3 to 5 people, and then you might have a platoon, which might be a dozen. You know, and then you go on up there, and you got several platoons. You get up to a company, might be a couple hundred people, but out of that couple hundred, a lot of support, so you only got maybe a little over 100, 150 actually involved in combat operations. And then when you hit up against everything, and then you go up against a battalion, you're talking about 1,000 guys.
Yeah. But, you know, what it comes down to, I know the Marine Corps is, and I'm sure the Army and the other branches probably do the same thing. But the Marine Corps, an infantry unit, is made up of four-man teams called a fire team. A squad has at least three four-man teams. And then a platoon has like 12 four-man teams. These men are, sometimes they're led by lance corporals or even a corporal or something, but they're four-man teams, and the leader can call in artillery. He knows how to use a map. And they, when they attack, they don't like run in a group of people. What they do is they attack in a four-man unit, and the fire team leader is calling out numbers. And he'll say three, and that number three guy runs. And he'll say one, and that guy runs. So the enemy never knows who's going to be running. You try not to have a pattern there. And when you've got an entire platoon moving in that type of four-man situation, it's like an army of four-man teams. And so it makes a big difference.
Well, the other thing, too, and we see this happen, I mean, it just happened here recently again in Champaign, Illinois, here this last week. I mean, they got a carjacking in the middle of the night. The guy runs into a house. They go up there. They set up the perimeter. Yeah. They forget about their outside perimeter. They're sitting all looking in. They're all clustered up, standing out there. They got their vehicles all parked up to each other. They can't get away from everything. And they're all focused in. And then it shows in the paper where these guys are all clustered together. I mean, there are like five or six of them, you know, nose to butt.
Right.
Going to go after this guy. And all I'm thinking is, man, these guys go up against the bad guys or somebody. He's going to take a shotgun, or he's going to set up a mouse trap, and a booby trap the thing, and you're going to lose all these guys. And we're seeing this happen all over, because with OIF and OEF, I mean, the perfect example, I mean, you know, we go back and we've talked about, you know, American Sniper. He lost his guys because they were stacking up, going into a building with no security, and they got nailed.
Right, right.
I mean, it was totally friggin' wrong.
Yeah, people drop the ball sometimes, but it's people, when you go into combat, you've got to be dedicated to the fact is, and I talked about it in the book, The Never-Ending War, is that you have to develop a mental hardness that allows you to fight people to the death. I mean, you just have to practice. And, I mean, when you go into something like that, you're working on just solid adrenaline. And if you can neutralize this person, you know, you're gonna get to go home. You'll get in, have a good life. But somebody is going to die. Now, in the police departments and the law enforcement, they don't have that luxury, because they're constantly being scrutinized. If they say something wrong, do something wrong, then they're going to be the bad guys, and it puts them really in an awkward position. You know, they think the more numbers you have, the more power you're showing, but it's not really that case. They're finding out these small units like SWAT and different things like that are more effective than 100 cops. I work out with my teacher in martial arts is a ninth-degree black belt. He's also a lieutenant in the police department. He's worked in every kind of unit throughout the last 30 years that you can imagine. And he would rather take a guy down by himself than have five or six cops piling in on a guy, because all you're doing is beating each other up and you're banging each other with flashlights and everything else and, you know, all these different batons and stuff. And sometimes if you can learn how to defend yourself, you don't need a half a dozen people. You can actually do better on your own, or maybe one or two, than you can a lot of people. And I know you want to talk a little bit about that, where it comes down to you, but that is the way it is. I mean, numbers are good, but when it comes down to personal security, you're going to have to take care of yourself.
I mean, when I was a combat medic years ago, and we had everything, and we had a very small group of us, and we went up against blue light, and this was 30-odd years ago. I mean, this is, blue light at that time, that was the number one force.
Right.
And what we did is we had to go up against their, assault their fixed position. Again, this was war games. And so three of us, basically, you know, two of the guys and myself as a medic, we went in and we got in. We snuck in, got in, everything. We didn't have all this equipment hanging all over us. We were basically in our, we had a rifle, and I had a 45, and they were carrying M16. We had our boonie hat on, and we had our clothes. We didn't have all this junk and hanging all over you.
Right.
And what I see today in the military, and the military is doing, they got more junk hanging on them. They got their helmet with all these gizmos and these lights and these computers. And you can't move.
Yeah.
You can't get down. The stuff weighs you down, and you can't go anyplace.
Right.
And then as we found out in Desert Storm, and this is why we had to do all our operations with a slide rule when we were cleaning up the mess, because the dang batteries die. And there ain't a Walmart at the corner to go get a battery.
When we got ready, you know, we lived in the jungle most of the time, but in the morning, now you never took off your clothes or your boots or anything like that. I mean, very seldom did you ever take your boots off. And because during the night, you definitely don't take them off because you never know what's going to happen. But when we got ready to move out in the mornings, you had your flak jacket on. You never hardly ever took that off. So you have your flak jacket on and your boots and everything. And then all you have to do is put a few frags in your pockets of your flak jacket and then a couple bandoliers of ammunition or, you know, magazines across your chest like the old, you know, the way the Mexican, what they used to call it, Pancho Villa or something, the way they did it, you know. And so you've got these bandoliers, and all you do is put a canteen of water in your pocket. Now, when you put on your pack on top of this, it may be a 60- or 80-pound pack, you are ready for combat because the first thing that happens or you detect is you dump that pack off your shoulders, and you are dressed for combat. Simple. It's a very simple deal. You're not making a lot of noise because if you make noise, the enemy hears you. Then he's ready for you. And so, you know, the bad guys, Doug, if you look at them, all they do is pack a rifle or a pistol. They're not packing all kind of super-duper. That's for the television stuff. But when it comes down to real life, the guy is probably, he's got a determination. He's got a plan of what he wants to do. He doesn't take a whole lot of ammunition or a whole lot of weapons with him to do it with either because it covers him up. I remember one time, and I wrote about it in my book, was that when we got out, wiped out that day, my squad of six men had to carry the weapons for the entire platoon because everybody else was either dead or wounded. And so we had to carry them the rest of that day until we got to a certain place. And we were carrying six or seven rifles apiece. And I said, you know, I laughed about it, and I said, man, I mean, if somebody jumped out, I'd probably get shot trying to figure out which rifle to shoot. And but that is what happens. They just get overloaded. Their brain gets overloaded. And the first thing you know, they get shot trying to figure out what to do.
You got all this gizmos hanging on to you. I mean, all of us have seen this stuff. And then
what
bothers me even more, it comes back in the civilian world. And the guy's out here hunting, or the cop's going to buy it. And then what's happened with the military, and I mean, this is part of the other scary thing under the mount operations things that people don't want to talk about, but it's there. The military was handing out all their equipment on down to the police, and then they were feeding them a lot of bull.
Right.
And so now they've got all this stuff, and they said, well, if the military used it, it's got to be neat. So, I mean, they an MRAP in the middle of town running up there. No concept at all. They still got to drive up to the bad guy. Then they got to get out of their MRAP and go after the bad guy. So the MRAP does zero good to them other than drove them from point A to point B. And they shouldn't be driving up so close that they're within the free fire zone to begin with.
Right.
I mean, somehow all this stuff is mixed, messed up, and then when we come to our civilian environment, I mean, you have to have a plan to protect you and your family. You have
you
to
do.
Have a plan, an organized plan with organized equipment and the stuff that's functional, usable, that you're totally competent in using to protect your household and everything. That doesn't mean you're going to go, you know, go after the bad guy or anything, but you have to have a plan in place to protect yourself until such time, if needed, that the cops or the police can come and respond.
Right.
But what we have seen over and over and over and over again is like, you know, my buddy the FBI said, the cops ain't nothing but historians. By the time they get there, it's all over.
Well,
and then they come rushing in
and
like,
you know,
the cavalry.
I mean, you definitely have to have a plan of what you're going to do. But the other part of that, you have to be able to practice what you're going to do. In the Marine Corps, we practiced. I mean, between battles, we were talking, we were practicing, we'd say maneuvers. The guy had to know he was number two or number one or number three or number four. He had to know, be able to move when his number was called in order to move forward, like the fire team thing. But you have to practice these things. And the biggest difference that I know of between the civilian world and the military world is that we had, in the military, we had to neutralize the enemy. There was no other question about it. So if you know that, if you sit down, if you lay down, if you play dead, or whatever you do, or you run backwards, you're going to get shot. The only thing you have to do, and this is a have-to thing, is that you have to move forward to whatever the problem is, and you have to neutralize that problem because it's not going to go away by itself. You're going to have to make it go away. Those guys got out of those Higgins boats in World War II and ran across those beaches. They didn't do it because they were having fun or it was a good day. They were trying to get to the enemy and kill them because the enemy was sitting there killing their men. And it's just that is a hard lesson you learn. But how do you use that in civilian life? Most civilians, I know this for a fact, I've seen it so many times, is that a lot of civilians who have never practiced that, yeah, they got a lot of big guns. But when it comes down to shooting each other and that guy's got big guns, you might throw yours down and run. Or you might leave him there and run. And you're thinking, well, if I don't have a gun, he's not going to shoot me. Well, that may not be the case.
Well, the same thing.
You just can't play dead.
The same thing we see, everybody, all this stuff has come out, well, I'm going to get this fancy gizmo, so I got all these fancy optics, and I got these red dots, and I got all these lasers and everything else, so this stuff is all hanging on my gun.
Right.
And,
well,
and
you
can't
good,
maneuver
you.
The gun to use it and get an accurate sight picture, and yeah. As you said, kill the individual that you have to, because when you get into a situation like that, and especially in the civilian world, the only time you can protect yourself or do it is when you're at ultimate threat to your life, imminent threat that you or your other one is going to be killed or seriously harmed.
Well, you know, it used to be, Doug, a long time ago, if you did burglary on a house that was occupied, they could charge you with a murder charge because you were attempting to go in that house with a weapon, and they assumed that you were going to use that weapon if you went in that house. And so it was a really heavy charge. You could really get capital crime out of that kind of thing for burglarizing a house with people inside that house. Well, it's not like that anymore. But it's the intent. And so if you see a guy breaking in your house, Doug, in the middle of the night, what are you going to do? Are you going to try to hold him? You're going to try to stop him? You're going to try to holler at him? You're going to try to... You know, I read a story. It was in a gun magazine where this guy had a lot of weapons in his house, and he's going away for about a week. So he took his wife around to every room, and he put a weapon in every room in that house and said, if somebody were to break in, you know, you've got a weapon in any room. And so he left, and it just so happened while he was gone, somebody broke in his house. And the woman attacked him with like a stiletto high heel and almost killed the guy. She never used the first weapon. And the reason was she never practiced with those weapons. Her first thing was to go and do what she normally would do. And so... you know, people that don't practice with weapons or practice maybe even procedures. I know with my children growing up, we used to practice fire drills in my house because if a fire ever happened, I wanted to make sure my kids knew how to get out of that house. Well, same thing in life. When you got bad guys doing bad things, you better have a plan. And you can have all the guns you want, but he may take a gun and use it on you. And so you have to do that. Doug, my book is about combat, but it's also about the faithfulness of God in combat. And I truly believe that's the thing that got me through some of that combat. I had to play dead. I had to do all these things. And it just so happened to be the same exact time I found out years later. I was ambushed between 5 and 5:30 in the afternoon in Vietnam. And I found out in North Carolina it was exactly 12 hours difference. My dad was praying for me in the morning as I was being ambushed in the afternoon. And I know that sounds a little strange. You have to read the book to understand it. But, you know, I truly believe our first line of defense would say, and God help me in this thing, because it's a bad guy. I don't think he's praying to God, but I'm going to pray to God. I'm going to say, Lord, help me. And I know there's been a lot of times in life that he has protected me from bad situations just by making me a little bit wiser. If you don't want a bad situation, stay away from bad situations. If they come to you, then you're going to have to deal with it. And just... you're going to have to live with the consequences of it. You say, I don't want to hurt nobody. Well, I don't want them hurting my family either. And so if you're going to have a gun, you have to be ready to use it.
I think all three of us and everybody else has been around and we've talked to and we've associated with, we came to that mindset where we've taken actions. I mean, you know, we deliberately set it up and we're going to take this life or we're going to save this life or we're going to be prepared, but we're not going to stop or hesitate along the way. And I think there was a big difference, and I know the difference I saw from Desert Storm, from Vietnam to Desert Storm, and having, you know, spending all the years and done the infantry stuff with the medic. It was that willingness.
Yeah.
What mindset do you have? Are you willing? What will you do? Are you prepared? Do you have the proper equipment?
Right.
I mean, It bothers me as I went through all the years. I mean, come in 67. When did you enlist, Ray? 66?
Yeah, 66, right.
I mean, you see all of the difference, and today all these guys want all this equipment and everything hanging all over them, and the same thing in the civilian world. They're going to buy all this equipment as if somehow this equipment is going to save and protect their butt.
It's not going to do it. I'm telling you, it'll weight you down and probably cumbers you about so bad that you won't. Look, when it happens, you're not thinking about flashlight, about laser, you're not thinking this. You're thinking about target, boom, 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 boom. And I did a lot of times out of fear because I was 19 years old and I was scared to death. And I didn't think about stuff. I was just thinking about eliminating the target. And when it comes down to it, you have to have equipment, but you have to be, you have to have that drive or whatever it is. You prepared yourself for it, and because it could cost you your life, your children, everything you have. And so you just have to be willing to live with the consequences and make sure you're legal, that type of things. But call 911. Somebody's trying to break in my house. I'm going to shoot them if they come in here. And then, you're prepared. You're prepared. You're prepared. And so you just have to have a mental position of that where you're ready for whatever comes.
I think the practice and, getting the qualified training from qualified instructors is important, too. But I've seen so many instructors, they did a little bit in the military, came out, and they got this crazy mindset today. Here's all this gizmos and all the equipment, so they're running up there. I mean, the first thing I learned when I was spent my 3 years in the infantry as a combat medic, and we'd learned it already before, is when you're getting into a situation, you want to be as low as you can. You don't want to be seen. You don't want to be heard. You don't want to be shining. You want to be moved like grease lightning. And when you got all this stuff hanging on, it's like when we went to Desert Storm, my full combat load, I weighed 165 pounds. Okay, that's just me and my socks and underwear.
Me too.
Okay? And when I got fully loaded, my full combat load that I was expected to carry, I was 285 pounds.
I can see that.
I had an M16 with 3,000 rounds. I had a .45 with 1,000 rounds. I had my medical aid bag, which we all carried. And then we had our sleeping bag. We had all our other crap. Still got a picture of it. It kind of looks like
you had extra stuff.
Because you know what you had to do, and you had to have that full combat load on when we got deployed, because you had to be weighed before you were put on the airplane.
That's true.
Well, we're
when
running
your enemy's
out of time
in range,
again.
Doug, so are you.
Next week is Veterans Day. We have to figure out what we're going to do special for Veterans Day, so we'll all work together. Anybody's got any ideas, let PRN know what you'd like to have. Thank you again, Ray. Thank you, Denise.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, listen, Denise, she's got it right there, and it's critical to do it. Thank you, and good evening.